From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin is off today. It's Here and Now. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin shook hands this morning at a summit in Vietnam. Back in Washington, Senate Republicans are scrambling for every vote on the tax cut plan they unveiled this week. But sexual misconduct allegations against Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore have taken some attention away from the tax cuts. Let's bring in our Friday politics roundtable. Jesse Holland, reporter with the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Doing well. And Domenico Montanaro is with us as well, lead politics editor for NPR. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with Roy Moore, who continues to deny allegations published by The Washington Post yesterday that he initiated sexual contact with a 14-year-old in 1979 when he was 32. There were also three other women who say that Moore pursued them when they were teenagers and he was in his 30s. Domenico, how likely is it at this point that Roy Moore drops out of the race?
It sounds like he's not going to drop out. And everyone has been saying on the Republican side, for the most part, that if these allegations are true, he should drop out. But he doesn't look like he's going to do so. It looks like he's digging in. I think what's really important here is that with the election being next month, that the Democrat in the race has actually been polling pretty close because he kind of is reflective of Alabama in many ways. And if the Democrat in the race were able to pull off a victory, which is still kind of an outside shot, but not impossible, if that Democrat were able to win, suddenly the Senate goes from 52-48 to 51-49.
Right.
And if Democrats were able to hold all of their Senate seats in 2018 and pick up the two in Arizona and Nevada. Now, these are long shots, but there is a path now. If they were able to do that, they could take back the Senate.
And Jesse, the Democrat in this case is Doug Jones. Do you think he has a chance of winning if Roy Moore stays in the race for the December 12th special election?
Well, these Washington Post allegations have definitely opened a door in Alabama for a Democrat. Now, it's been a long time since any Democrats have done well in deep South races, statewide races like in Alabama. But seeing the backlash we've saw in Virginia against Republicans with Ed Gillespie losing in the gubernatorial race to Ralph Northam, there may be some Republicans out there who are just sick of all the controversies and are either going to stay home or willing to give another party a chance. So this whole thing has opened a door that wasn't open 2 weeks ago.
And what about for the Republican Party? Many Republicans now in the position of defending somebody who's accused of sexual misconduct with a 14-year-old. Let's listen. There's some finger pointing that's going on about Moore's candidacy. Josh Holmes, former aide to the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, told the New York Times, "This is what happens when you let reckless, incompetent idiots like Steve Bannon go out and recruit candidates who have absolutely no business running for the U.S. Senate." But last night in New Hampshire, Steve Bannon, who is Trump's former chief strategist, who now runs Breitbart News, pointed out that the Washington Post was among the first to report on Trump's Access Hollywood tape in which he bragged about grabbing women. Here's Bannon.
The Bezos, Amazon, Washington Post that dropped that dime on Donald Trump is the same Bezos, Amazon, Washington Post that dropped the dime this afternoon on Judge Roy Moore. Now, is that a coincidence? That's what I mean when I say opposition party.
Domenico, what does this mean for the Republican Party and for Steve Bannon and his political capital?
Well, first of all, if I can go back to that for a second with Bannon, you know, is this a coincidence that the Washington Post is a good reporting outfit? It should be the rest of that answer, rest of that question, because the Access Hollywood tape was real. I mean, right. it was a true thing. Is Bannon suggesting that the Washington Post should have covered up the fact that the person who was the Republican nominee for president was bragging about groping women and saying that he could abuse his own celebrity? You know, that's news. And if, you know, as a 30-something-year-old prosecutor, Roy Moore was trying to have a sexual relationship with minors, with not just one, but with several who've come forward now, that's news. So I don't know if he's thinking we shouldn't report on those things because it could hurt his chosen candidates. But I think in the interest of the American public and in the interest of people of Alabama in this case, they probably want to know those things.
Jesse, you brought up the election on Tuesday and the Virginia gubernatorial race. We also saw female candidates, and I bring this up because of what we've just been talking about with Roy Moore. We saw female candidates swept into elected offices across the country on Tuesday, saying that their anger at President Trump inspired them to run.
Well, this is something that we've been tracking for a while since the presidential election, that we thought that there would be a backlash against President Trump. And what we're seeing is that a number of people who maybe in the past would not have considered running for public office threw their names into the ring and said, you know what, I'm going to see if I can change things in Washington. So we saw a lot of candidates that that ran in Virginia and in New Jersey and around the country that we may not have seen before. And we actually saw a lot of voters show up in these off-year elections that we might not have seen otherwise.
Right.
One of the more interesting things in Virginia is the women's vote. We saw white women go for the Democrat at almost 51%. But when you break out black women from that number, they went for the Democrat at 91%.
Wow.
Which is even for African American voting for Democrat, that is an incredible number in an off election year. So we see that female vote cranking up as we get toward the midterm election.
All right. Well, meanwhile, in Washington, Republicans have been continuing their push for tax cuts. A House committee passed the plan yesterday, sending it to the full House for a vote next week. The Senate unveiled their plan, which is somewhat different than the House proposal. Here's the House Speaker Paul Ryan defending that plan.
We're actually letting people keep more of their own money. We're cleaning out the loopholes of the tax code and having a fairer tax system. So we're going to have faster economic growth, bigger paychecks, fairer taxes. That's not an unpopular thing to do. And oh, by the way, this is something we ran on.
Domenico, a lot of people have pointed out that this tax plan does look like it's going to be giving a big tax cut to the wealthy, and some middle-class families may actually see their taxes go up. How likely is it at this point that Republicans will be able to get something passed?
Well, right now you're seeing an argument try to be played out, this argument between Republicans and Democrats, Republicans saying that the middle class will benefit from this, and you're seeing Democrats say, no, that's not the case. You saw Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, say that this is a lose-lose situation for Republicans. It's lose if they pass it and lose if they don't, because if they pass it, it'll be so unpopular, and if they don't pass it, then it shows that they're ineffective in their ability to try to pass any legislation. And that has been a problem for Republicans, and it's not clear if they're going to have the votes on this. They've already got two Republicans, Bob Corker and Rand Paul, who are saying because it adds $1.5 trillion to the deficit that they're not in favor of that. And you're seeing Jeff Flake now from Arizona add his voice to whether or not he thinks something should add to the deficit. He says it should not. And there are some concerns from other Republicans, Susan Collins, who doesn't think that the wealthy should benefit, and Mike Lee, as well as Marco Rubio from Utah and Florida, saying that they think the child care tax credit needs to be increased more than the $650 increase that this bill gives.
So some Republicans on the fence about this. But Jesse, what about Democrats? Isn't it possible that some Democrats could vote in favor of tax cuts?
Well, you may see one or two in the House, but it's entirely unlikely that any of the Senate Democrats are going to break ranks and help pass a Republican tax bill. One of the things that really interests me here is that one of the things that a GOP-controlled Congress is almost required to do is pass a tax cut bill. Hmm. But when you look back at 2017, what were the major legislative accomplishments of this year for Republicans in their first year with a Republican president and a Republican Congress? They don't really have much to point to. So something's got to break for the Republicans before the end of this year. And they're hoping that the tax cut bill, they'll be able to say in 2017, when you gave us control of Congress and the White House, we cut your taxes. Right now, with the internal arguments they're having, it's looking less and less likely they're going to be able to say that.
One more thing I want to to get your thoughts on before we wrap up this segment, and that is President Trump's trip to Asia. He was in China, he was in Japan and South Korea, he's now in Vietnam. And it seems that he stayed surprisingly focused on Asia, given all of the domestic news at the elections, Roy Moore, the church shooting that happened while he was there. Domenico, your thoughts on that?
He might want to stay in Asia because he's been able to stay out of news and hasn't had much of the focus on him. You know, he was able to kind of talk about some of what are his usual generic policies, especially when it comes to America First and trade. And it is highly ironic, given that the United States was at the forefront of trying to create an APEC and a little bit more of globalization. But that's the Trump message, and other allies are just letting that roll off their shoulders because that's what they expect.
And just a few seconds here, Jesse, but your thoughts on the Trump trip?
Well, one of the things you have to keep in mind is that he never gave up his Twitter, so he found time to tell the Republican candidate in Virginia,
right,
Ed Gillespie,
that's
if he hadn't, if he hadn't ran away from him, he would have won. Keep in mind, we can tell he's keeping his eyes on what's going on in America. It's just that he hasn't said much about it.
Well, and it was only one tweet, although now they can be twice as long. So Jesse Holland, reporter with the Associated Press, and Domenico Montanaro with NPR. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Not too long after the massacre in Sutherland Springs, Texas, on Sunday, Devin Kelly was identified as the shooter. People started to Google that name, and Google served up top news results linking him to a left-wing political organization. Other results suggested he was a Muslim convert, and some suggested he was a supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders. None of these affiliations appear to be true, which leads us back to an ongoing problem with the way tech companies deliver breaking news to users. Ben Johnson covers technology for Here and Now and joins us. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And give us a little more detail here. Where were these false stories coming from?
Basically, a lot of dubious conspiracy theory websites and Twitter or YouTube accounts. So one result, for instance, came from Prison Planet, which is a website affiliated with InfoWars, the outlet of Alex Jones, famous conservative radio host and conspiracy theorist. Also, YouTube videos, specifically channels that are from users who often push conspiracy theories, and the state-funded Russian news site RT, which cited some of those sources and later retracted part of its report. Basically, a lot of places that a discerning news consumer hopefully wouldn't really trust.
So how did these all show up in Google's news search results?
So partially thanks to this kind of popular on Twitter module that in a breaking news situation will appear right below top stories when you Google something or someone in the news, Jeremy. It's part of a partnership between Twitter and Google that delivers Twitter top news in Google results. These results were also part of Google's autocomplete function. So that's when you start typing something into the search bar and you get these suggestions of what you're about to type and they're looking for. This is one of those predictive technologies that Google really touts as the power of its use of big data, both in terms of what other people have searched for, but also maybe your own search history. And because websites that purposefully made a concerted effort to associate the shooter politically with the left, Google's algorithm actually presumably started picking up on those results and reinforced them when people started clicking on these fake news reports.
This sounds awfully familiar, I must say, with all the news that we've been covering about the tech companies and the election and Russian hacking. Just last week, the top executives from Google, Facebook, and Twitter were on Capitol Hill testifying about fake news and election interference. Are these the same issues that we're dealing with now?
Absolutely. Last week, we heard from the testimony of tech companies in Washington that during the election, we had content on Facebook designed to confuse voters reach 126 million Facebook users, right, 131,000 Twitter messages, over 1,000 videos posted on YouTube. Now, we should point out that there's a difference between ads, which Russian agents were apparently boosting with money on Facebook to target certain specific groups, and regular posts, which are more general in their targeted audience. audience. And in the case we're now discussing, the shooting in Texas, you had top search results that may have reached a really wide audience, so non-targeted. Now, this is part of like Google's special sauce. It's proprietary. We don't know exactly how the algorithm works, but presumably they were reaching a much wider audience.
So what are these companies saying that they're going to do to fix this problem, if anything?
That's a great question. Google spokesperson has said they're working on the autocomplete function specifically. It is supposed to react to user search activity and interests. And in this case, the tool was not working, quote, as intended, they say. YouTube, owned by Google, of course, continues to say it is working on search results, though it said that after similar problems following the Las Vegas mass shooting, and these problems, these kinds of problems still surfaced in the wake of this shooting. And there are also differences between these tech companies, right? Like, it's a lot easier for agents posing as real users to create fake news content and boost it on Facebook with money. And then you have Snapchat, where there's almost zero fake news content compared to a ton of other platforms. Snapchat says this is because they use more human curation and only partner with sort of vetted news organizations. So the larger issue here is that tech companies who claim not to be media companies, by the way, have still built these like massive, powerful media delivery vehicles. And those massive media delivery vehicles, more often than not, aren't actually curated by people. They're automated. And so these companies are trying to react to this. And at the end of the day, I think tech companies probably need to fully face the role they play and actually boost their human teams that fix the issues that the algorithms serve up.
So we humans still have some value in the world.
Hopefully.
Okay. I want to ask you about one more thing while we have you, and that is that Twitter announced this week that they will officially allow 280 characters per tweet instead of 140. A lot of people have been talking about this on Twitter. Stephen Colbert tweeted, "Dear Twitter, if there's one thing we could ask for from 2017, it wouldn't be more Twitter. Thanks, Stephen."
Yeah.
Why are they doing this?
So Twitter tested this, according to Jack Dorsey, and it worked out well for some users that they tested it with, and now they're rolling it out to everyone. The company presumably feels like it's going to be better for the platform, better for people interacting on the platform. Jeremy, as you and I know, in radio, you know, good writing is usually concise writing. So I don't know if 280 characters is actually going to make the experience that much better. But when Twitter was first on the scene, people didn't know how to describe it, and they described it as a microblogging platform. So I guess it's like maybe getting closer to that now.
That's Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Doctors at Massachusetts General Hospital for Children in Boston were confronted with a difficult decision last year. It involved a pair of conjoined 2-year-old twin girls who were brought to the hospital from East Africa. One was in failing health, and doctors thought that if she died, her healthier sister would die as well. But operating to separate them would lead to the death of the sick twin. She would not be able to survive on her own. The doctor's report on this case was recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Carrie Goldberg from member station WBUR has the story.
The East African twins were born conjoined into a sort of a Y shape. They had separate heads and torsos, but they were connected lower down at the abdomen and the pelvis. They shared a liver and a bladder and other lower body organs and had just 3 legs in all. One of the sisters, the doctors call her Twin A, also had heart and lung disease so serious they say she was imminently dying.
And if we sit here and do nothing, that twin will die. And because she's attached to her sister, the other one will die as well. And just by physiology, it usually happens within hours to days later.
Dr. Brian Cummings is the chair of Mass General's Pediatric Ethics Committee. He was called in to consult on the ethics of the case. He says the healthier sister was acting as the sicker sister's heart-lung machine, giving her oxygen.
And so if we act, we will be able to save one sister from dying, but one will die in that act.
It was a choice between 2 terrible options.
No one wants to do something that's going to lead to the potential death of a patient. At the same time, no one wants to sit here and watch 2 young ladies die, knowing that we might be able to do something to save one. So how do we proceed where we have really 2 undesirable outcomes, but we can't change those outcomes?
Cummings says the dilemma is reminiscent of the famous trolley problem in ethics. A trolley is hurtling down a track toward a group of people. Is it morally acceptable to push someone onto the track to block it? There's no simple answer. Scholars write whole dissertations on various permutations of the problem. Dr. Alan Goldstein is the chief of pediatric surgery at Mass General and led the surgical team on the case.
As physicians, we are trained only to save a life. And this forced us to think outside of that matrix, to consider that sometimes saving a life is, you know, more complicated.
The Mass General team considered the decision from every ethical dimension, including even whether the weaker twin, Twin A, could be considered an aggressor because she was piggybacking on Twin B's circulation. In that light, could an operation to separate them be considered a form of self-defense? Ultimately, Cummings says, the team focused on a practical question. What should be the process for deciding?
And our process was, let's engage all our stakeholders. Let's have room for divergent opinion about this. Let's think about what we are comfortable offering as a medical facility, and then let's offer that to the family.
The family, after much discussion, chose the operation to separate the twins. Goldstein says the medical staffers were free to opt out of the operation, and a few did.
Individuals both in the anesthesia and surgery side that said, this is not for me. This is wrong. We should, you know, we're doctors. We never end the life.
But most opted in, and the operation at Mass General went ahead last year. It took 14 hours. The surgical team had to divide the twins' intestines, liver, pelvic bones, and more. Even their skin had to be carefully divided, and a major artery they shared. Goldstein says a separate OR was ready to support the weaker Twin A after the separation, but to no avail.
She died relatively quickly after the artery was divided and before the separation was completed.
Twin B recovered well from the surgery and even came to a presentation of her case at Mass General. Brian Cummings says it was a powerful moment.
And she came into the room and everyone was clapping, and she loved it. She waved to the crowd. She was so happy. And I think it really hit home for everyone that was involved, like that it was the right thing to do, and we did our best here.
The doctors say Mass General is not publicly identifying the family or even the East African country they're from because they faced hostility there for their choice. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
A major power line in Puerto Rico has failed, dropping the percentage of the island with power from 40 to 18%. Whitefish Energy, the Montana-based contractor under investigation by the FBI, had worked on that line. It has been 7 weeks since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, and thousands of military personnel are still there to help. Jay Price of WUNC is embedded with the North Carolina National Guard in Puerto Rico.
It's hard to imagine a less glamorous mission.
Yeah.
Do you have field dirt? Gravel, anything like that put in?
Lieutenant Colonel Cale Moody of the North Carolina National Guard commands Task Force Rhino. The troops are here to clear and repair washed out roads on the south side of Puerto Rico. The weather isn't helping.
We had like 5 days of straight rain, I mean torrential rain. It was like a tropical storm. So it's keeps carving it up.
Moody's teams are still finding small communities cut off by road damage from landslides and flash floods. Without roads, trucks can't deliver food and water, and utility crews can't get in to repair power lines and replace the estimated 62,000 utility poles that are down.
We're identifying new missions every day and doing what we can as quick as we can, safely as we can, but when our time's up, there'll still be plenty of work here.
Every day, the task force sends reconnaissance teams to drive the roads, record the locations and types of damage, and make notes about the kinds of repairs needed and what types of equipment can actually be brought to the site.
This is our first time this way. We've been to the mountains up in the western central area, but not this location.
First Lieutenant Aaron Graham, who's in the passenger seat up front, is a firefighter in her civilian life.
Mainly our purpose is to go out, find the work, and then, like, I'm there to assess. I take notes like, hey, do I think it's possible to get a 916 at the bottom of this hill, which is a low-boy tractor trailer? And
Graham's driver and translator is specialist Angela Moll, a National Guard medic who's a nurse's aide at a North Carolina hospital. Halfway up a mountain, Moll hits the brakes. A washout has eaten away the soil under a small bridge, opening a gap nearly all the way across the road. When Graham gets out to assess the repair it will need, a local resident, Jose Martinez, walks up. His tiny community is called Bayaha. As Hull translates, he explains they're parking their cars down the mountain and carrying food and water up.
Okay, so once this problem gets fixed, it'll improve the situation over 100%. Right now, when it rains and it starts to flood, it goes into some of the houses that are closer to the creek.
Graham says that many places she and Moll stop, residents come out hoping they've arrived with food or water.
We do make sure that they know that, that we will let our hire know that no one has been here, so at least they have a voice. Not that we're just there, hey, we can't help you, we're only here to this. So we do tell them that, hey, we will put up that somebody is coming, and somebody knows about you, and somebody knows that you haven't been here, but...
Task Force Rhino's first troops got here October 3rd. Since then, a saying has become common as they talk about what they see on the roads and in the communities across southern Puerto Rico.
Every day seems to get a little bit better.
A little bit. A little bit more electricity over here, a little bit more water and food over there, but just a little bit. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Bayaha, Puerto Rico.
It is white truffle season. If you've gone to an upscale restaurant recently, you may have noticed a white truffle risotto on the menu. It's probably the most expensive entree. The white truffle is a delicious but very expensive fungus, as is the winter black truffle, which is coming into season now. Ian Perkiastha knows truffles well. He's the creator and owner of Regalis Foods, and he's been importing them since he was a teenager in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Ian writes about his life in the book Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground. I spoke with him earlier this year about the book and asked him how he got into truffles at such a young age.
Well, my family actually relocated from Houston, Texas to rural Arkansas when I was 15. And the move to Arkansas was really to pursue a simpler lifestyle. My uncle and his family were living in Arkansas, and I started spending a lot of time with my uncle, who is an avid outdoorsman, and he showed me how to mushroom forage. So the first few mushrooms he showed me how to forage for were morels and chanterelles and black trumpets. And I had always loved cooking and eating well, and so I kind of became obsessed with all things mushroom-related. And I knew that truffles were regarded as the king of all mushrooms. And so on a visiting trip to Houston, I was fortunate enough to go to dinner with some of our old affluent friends from Houston, and they told me that I could order anything on the menu. And I saw this black truffle ravioli dish with a foie gras sauce. And so I ordered it. And from the very moment I tasted it, it was this amazing, unusual, earthy flavor, and I just became totally obsessed. And so when I returned to Arkansas, I begged my parents to give in to buy me a truffle or two, and their immediate reaction was, of course not, because Fayetteville was kind of our reset at all things lavish and fancy. And so I decided to pool together my savings from several Christmases in hopes of buying my first shipment of truffles.
And selling them to some of the restaurants in the area. I was wondering because, when you go out to dinner, even in some of the biggest cities in this country, at some of the fanciest restaurants, it's still sometimes hard to find a place that has truffles on the menu. But you were able to find a number of places in Fayetteville or around Fayetteville that wanted to buy your truffles.
Yes, so the minimum was actually a kilo of truffles, and so my original intention was not to sell them, but to just buy a few truffles to eat, for personal consumption. And so I found this French company in France that was willing to send me a kilo of truffle, and when they arrived, I realized there's actually quite a lot of truffles here, and that's when I decided why not try to sell a portion of these to some local restaurants. So I cold called the three best restaurants in town, and my dad drove me, and I stopped at Target along the way picking up a little kitchen scale, and I basically just pretended like I was making a delivery and showed up to the chef and said, oh, I have, you know, these truffles from France. Would you like, you know, to buy a few? And so
how do you convince somebody to buy truffles from you when you're – how old at this point?
So I was 15.
15, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a simpler process than you might think. I just showed up and said, you know, I've got these truffles. Do you care to take a look? And I don't know if it was the novelty of this young buck-tooth kid walking in with truffles or the quality of the truffles themselves that completed the sale. But I had fun with it, and I turned a profit, and I just kept reinvesting and reinvesting into larger and larger orders. And my parents would take turns driving me to local larger cities, and I would hop out and cold call, and I established this little company in Arkansas, and I turned my parents' garage into a shipping center, and I would go to the airport after school several days a week to go pick up the truffles that had arrived, and I would, you know, make sales in between classes.
Did your teachers notice that you were doing this work while you were in class? You talk about in this book, you know, sitting with your iPhone under your desk making deals.
Well, we had like a no-tolerance policy with cell phones, so if I was caught, it would be taken, and I couldn't get it back until the end of the day. And then I think the second offense was not getting it back for a week or something, so I had to be pretty careful when making the sales. And so I eventually was having issues with quality, and so I started looking online for another source, and that's when I found an Italian company that was looking for U.S. representation. And I sent them an email, and they were based in Italy, and I was, of course, based in Arkansas, and they were going to be in New York for the annual Fancy Food Show, which is one of the main trade events of the specialty food industry that summer. And I was also going to be in New York that summer looking at different colleges. And so we decided to meet in New York, and I remember they asked if I could meet for a beer, and I said, oh, sure, I'll meet, you know, for a beer. And so I ordered a ginger beer in hopes that they wouldn't realize I was underage, and it worked. And we had this great conversation, and they decided to offer me this job to sell truffles for them. And so my job was to find all the customers, and their job was to provide the truffles. And so senior year is when I started working for them full time, you know, in between classes and after school. And I told my parents after graduation that I was moving to New York to strike it big in the truffle business, to do this in the big leagues.
A lot of people may wonder how you, as a young man, and even as a boy, I mean, you call yourself Truffle Boy on the cover of this book, had the ability to determine what was a good truffle and what was a bad truffle. Is there something about your sense of smell or taste that helped you, you know, do well at this job?
Well, everything I've learned in these 9 years has been self-taught. That's not to say I've had a lot of help along the way in terms of meeting so many amazing people in this industry. But I have always loved cooking, and I grew up cooking with my grandfather and my mother, and entertaining and cooking for people was always such a strong importance. And so I've just applied that same passion for food to truffles.
What is the difference between a black truffle and a white truffle?
The two main differences, other than being different varieties entirely, is that they come into season at a different time. The white truffle from October through December in the fall, and the black truffle, or the winter black at least, between December and March. They have a very different aroma altogether. The white truffle is a very garlicky, kind of cheesy aroma. A black truffle smells more earthy, almost cognac-y, with this just very intoxicating, dark, you know, musk. But I've heard everything from white truffles smell like marijuana and Italian sausage to, you know, garlic and cheese and so forth. So it's very hard to describe.
And you write that there's now a little bit of change in the market because of truffles coming from China.
Well, the Chinese have their own indigenous variety. Everyone that sells truffles goes by the Latin name of the truffle variety. So the white truffle is tuber magnatum, and the black winter that everyone is familiar with is tuber melanosporum. And the Chinese truffle has its own Latin name, tuber indicum, and it looks identical to the famed winter black truffle.
But it's not truffles, as good.
It's not as good because it actually has no natural aroma. And so what companies will do is they'll mix these Chinese truffles in with the winter black truffles, and truffles give off this very intense aroma. And so they'll perfume the skin of the Chinese truffle, and at first glance, it'll look and smell like the real thing, but only after a day or two will the smell fade, and you realize you have this bland truffle look-alike.
Which brings us to another point that you make in this book, which is that the truffle business is kind of shady.
It is. It totally is shady. And I think part of the success that I've been so lucky to have with my company and my reputation is that I'm very transparent about all the ingredients that we sell. What I'm trying to do with Truffle Boy is to also demystify these once very underground, luxe ingredients that had these snobby reputations and be as educated as possible, and also try to just make these ingredients a little bit more approachable for a younger generation.
So if somebody out there is listening and they've never had a truffle and they never thought that they should spend the money on getting truffles at some fancy restaurant, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say if someone is wanting to try an ingredient that literally smells like nothing else they've ever had, then the truffle is the ingredient for them. And truffles have been, you know, lustful and highly regarded for centuries for having this intoxicating aroma and flavor. So I would definitely encourage interested, adventuresome eaters to seek out truffles.
That's Ian Perkiasta, who is the author of the new book, Truffle Boy, My Unexpected Journey Through the Exotic Food Underground. He's also the creator and owner of Regalis Foods. Ian, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hundreds of thousands of people from Central America are in suspense about their immigration status after the Trump administration this week took steps to roll back a program known as Temporary Protected Status. TPS lets people from certain countries dealing with dangerous situations like a natural disaster or civil war stay in the United States temporarily. On Monday, the Department of Homeland Security announced the end of temporary protected status for about 2,500 Nicaraguans living in the U.S., giving them until January of 2019 to change their status or leave. The Nicaraguans were granted the special status after Hurricane Mitch hit Central America in 1998. Temporary protected status is also set to expire soon for people from Honduras, Haiti, and El Salvador unless the administration acts. Yanira Arias is National Campaigns Manager for the group Alianza Americas. She's from El Salvador and is a recipient of TPS. She joins us from San Francisco. Yanira, were you surprised by the decision to roll back TPS for some this week?
We were expecting that decision based on what was announced for Haiti back in April. We should remember that as well, that the Obama administration canceled three other TPS recipient countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea in 2016. So we were having some indicators thus far. We were not expecting a six-month for Honduras and a 12-month termination announcement for Nicaragua. But that's really disturbing considering the situations in every country that thus far have received a decision from DHS.
And what about the El Salvadorans? This is the biggest group of people who have TPS, including you. Do you think that Salvadorians are going to lose their temporary protected status?
We are preparing for the worst, and we think that the 195,000 TPS recipients, including myself, we're going to be receiving bad news. We're trying to prepare getting legal assistance and counseling for the families. There are thousands of families with U.S. citizen children.
Right.
And that's something that the administration is not taking in consideration, that this is an issue and a humanitarian issue.
On the other hand, critics of this program say it was never intended to last as long as it has. Temporary is right there in the name, and these countries have long since recovered from the natural disasters that were initially the reason for TPS.
Perhaps some of the situations are not there, but the countries we are talking, for example, Haiti, never recover from the 2010 earthquake. 60,000 people are continue to be homeless in Haiti. So we cannot say that although it's that event happened in 2010, the situation has been completely solved.
Are you prepared to go back to El Salvador if that's what it comes to?
I am not. I migrated due to gender violence, and I had, in some points, I had to fight back in order to survive. So I'm not ready. That was in 1999, and I decided to migrate in 2000. And now my country is one of the most violent countries in the region. And I am not ready. The violence towards women continue to be a push factor for forced migration.
So if the government ends TPS for Salvadorans, you'll simply stay illegally in the U.S.?
I will assess other legal options and to find what opportunities I have. But after close to 20 years in the United States, I believe I do have the right for a opportunity of adjustment of status. And at the moment, what we're doing is to organize and work hard with some elected officials that, for instance, Representative Velasquez, Curbelo, that have already introduced a couple of bills for adjustment of status for TPS recipients. Those are some of my options right now. Organize and advocate to make sure that we continue to communicate with Congress and the administration to find a legal path for more than 3,000 families.
You mentioned that this is not a surprise to you that this is happening because President Trump and others have talked about this. The Washington Post is reporting that the White House has been putting pressure on the Department of Homeland Security to curtail the TPS program. Do you think this is getting too political?
It is. Definitely is politics over policy. The State Department knows best the situation in Haiti, the in-country conditions in Honduras, El Salvador. There is no brainer that at the policy level, they do have all the facts, all the information. This is about politics, and most of all, it's part of a racist and xenophobic agenda of this administration.
That's Yanira Arias, who is National Campaigns Manager for the group Alianza Americas and a recipient of temporary protected status in the United States. Yanira, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin's back Monday. It's Here and Now.